Wow, thank you. A few short years ago, a short article ran in Time magazine, which let me know that I am among the happiest people in the land, or the happiest at my job anyway. Really now, the magazine did a survey of people who were the most happy and least happy at their jobs. Whatever criteria they were using for happiness, the authors didn't say, but members of the clergy from a wide range of faith traditions came in first. Firefighters came in second. Ministers, firefighters, and so on down the line until you got to gas station attendants who, again, according to whatever research methods were being used here, came in last, were least happy at their jobs. I only report this stuff. I don't explain it. I get my gas across the street over here most of the time, and the folks over there seem pretty happy at their jobs, but maybe they weren't asked. Well, try as I might, once I decided I was going to lead off a sermon with this news, I could not come up with any kind of cute and clever-sounding reason as to why it is that ministers and firefighters are at the top of the job happiness list. I really tried hard, but the punchline just would not come. The setup sounded pretty promising, you know. Why are ministers and firefighters the most happy at their jobs? And then I got nothing. If any of you can come up with a good punchline for that in the next, let me know. Now that I've probably lost at least half of you, are going to spend the next 20 minutes trying to figure that out. I'm going to proceed with the sermon anyway. As you might imagine, this article generated a fair amount of chatter on this UU minister's chat line that I'm on, as we all were trying to figure out if we're really as happy as we're supposed to be. And I dashed off a few thoughts of my own under the heading of, if you're happy and you know it, I clicked send to the chat line, let it go out there, and went on about my business. And then over the next day or so, I started getting a number of requests from several of my colleagues asking if they could quote what I'd said in their sermons. I answered, sure, as long as you say where you got it. And then I went scurrying back to see what it was I had written. I also decided if my esteemed colleagues were going to be using my stuff in their sermons, well, what the heck, I might as well use it myself, and which is just what I did have done with some minor editing. Here's what I said, some of what I said. Throwing in the usual caveats about happiness being hard to define and knowing that we've all had our less than happy times as ministers, I can buy into what Time magazine is reporting. I hardly go around deliriously happy all the time, as that would be pretty hard to take and make me hard to take as well. But with nearly four decades in the ministry, I don't know of anything else I could have done with my life to this point that has given me a better overall sense of satisfaction than being a minister has. Here's why I think we in the clergy come out at or near the top of the happiness scale. First, ours is one of the few callings and professions left, and this is especially true of the UU ministry, where you can still be an actual Renaissance person and make a living at it. I don't know any other career I could have chosen that allows me to draw on as wide a range of interests and involvements as I have and still feel they're part of a larger effort or whole. To put it another way, being a minister has allowed me to live a largely unfragmented life, even with the fragmented times every one of us experiences now and then. I wasn't done. Second, ministry is not an end in itself, or only a way to make a living. Granted, there are, as we all know, times when it feels just like a job and a pain in the wherever job at that, but ministry is really about serving a higher cause or purpose, named in a variety of ways that transcend even the word ministry. I know there are other professions that can rightly make such a claim, but I think it's especially pronounced with us. I think a fundamental component of happiness or a state of well-being is living with a sense and with an awareness that you're participating in something greater than yourselves, and ministry gives us that. And then, just so I would wrap the whole thing up with at least one foot on the ground, I added this. I'm going to save what I've written here so I can refer to it when I'm in one of my what the hell was I thinking when I chose to do this kinds of moods. And indeed I have. And even though I wrote all that just a few short years ago, the words are sentiments I've been reminding myself about for a much longer period of time. More to the point, they are thoughts that I've looked back upon and thoughts that have been with me in much more recent days now as I wind down this wonderful and amazing and crazy career. And when I think back to that online conversation, though, I believe that my colleagues and I were really talking more about joy than we were talking about happiness. And I don't mean to split semantic hairs here, but I think it's possible to live a life of joy without always being happy or without always having fun. One of my now deceased UU minister friends expressed this idea very well in a meditation he wrote on the topic of joy and fun. I pointed to it, I briefly touched on it last Sunday. I'm going to expand upon it now. The words are by the late Reverend John Taylor. He once wrote, "It's not difficult to bring fun into our lives, but it's a lifelong task to find joy. Fun arrives, contributes its brief sensation, and leaves. Joy is a product of effort, time, and sacrifice. It is pride from the great stones of existence. Fun is an escape, which we all need. Joy is fulfillment, which we all seek." Well, just for the record, I'm in favor of fun. I seek out both joy and fun, actually. Now, fun, one of my ideas of fun, is sitting around with a few friends and a few brews and a nice spread of food and watching the Patriots thrash their latest opponent, even when they get away with one like they did last Sunday. Well, that's the kind of joy that provides very well what John Taylor calls the escape that we all need. That's the fun, the kind of fun that provides the escape we all need. Joy, on the other hand, as Reverend Taylor is using the word, is more of an ongoing quest for what he calls the fulfillment we all seek. Looping back to my comments about ministry, it has provided me, ministry has, with that fulfillment, even though it hasn't always been fun. As also noted last Sunday, joy is one of the four themes of the Advent season, as observed by Christians at this time of year, approaching Christmas Day. While on the Christian calendar, Joy Sunday was last week, as I say, I'm picking up the theme today. And to Reverend Taylor's wise words, I would add these from the 18th century British romantic poet William Blake. "Joy and woe are woven fine, clothing for the soul divine. Under every grief and pine runs a joy with silken twine." The language may be archaic, even though that poem of Blake's is contained in our hymnal. The words are wise. For what Blake and Taylor are each saying in their own way is that joy is something meaningfully arrived at, sometimes in the midst of the tests and the challenges and even the pains that life inevitably places upon us. So what I'd like to do then for the next several minutes is to offer a few perspectives which, while not guaranteeing joy in the sense I'm describing it, can hopefully keep us open to it, keep us alive to the possibility of that fulfillment we all seek, which we can on occasion find and realize. One perspective to lead off is to maintain an awareness that we live in the midst of the choices we have made and the ones that have been made for us. When I was working several years ago with Rick Maston on the book that he and I got out about his life and ministry, and which we published about 4 years ago, and less than a year, as it turned out, before he died, Rick specifically requested that the book end with his poem, "Master of Ceremonies." Rick, as most of you know, is best known in UU circles for his poem and song and hymn, "Let It Be a Dance." That's only one of the hundreds that he wrote in his lifetime. And he wrote "Master of Ceremonies" after he had been given a diagnosis of prostate cancer. These are a few of the lines. "I refuse to believe in personal free choice. It feels like I have it. But when I back away from something I've chosen, it always turns out the choice I made was based on something I didn't choose. I arrived predetermined. Gifts and talents, DNA, IQ, disposition, all of which begat the artist, that begat the actor, playwright, that begat the troubadour, that begat the minister, that begat the poet, that begat the minister. Rick is expressing in a poetic way here what the theologian Paul Tillich said when he maintained that we are creatures of finite freedom, meaning the freedom we have is one that is exercised within certain boundaries that life places upon us, including our mortality. Robert Frost said pretty much the same thing when he said that freedom is the ability to move easy in harness. In other words, to be able to move within the constraints that life does place upon you. Back to Rick's poem. I asked myself, how lucky can you be? Able to make a good livelihood by assisting in the creation of unforgettable moments. For the couples I danced with on the beaches and rocky promontories on the Big Sur coast. Those last lines refer to weddings that Rick officiated as a UU minister in the Big Sur area of California. Michelle and I got to attend one of them when I was working on the book. It really was a delightful occasion. So what Rick is really celebrating in the overall poem is the life he was able to create for himself, to give himself, within the time-bound existence he had living for it and with the kind of constraints that were also placed upon it. And so he closes the poem with these words. For someone who doesn't believe his choices are free, I rejoice in the life that has chosen me. As noted, Rick wrote that poem against the backdrop of a cancer diagnosis that did, in time, take his life. And he certainly had his less than joyful moments when it came to dealing with it at times. But he still maintained the spirit of this poem throughout that whole time. Joy and woe are indeed woven fine. To be able to look at the givens of our lives and the finite freedom choices we made in the face of those givens, and then be able to say, I rejoice in the life that has chosen me, is indeed, I feel, to know joy. Moving on, yet another condition or perspective for keeping joy alive and available, I believe, is to have a sense of peace with one's personal past, with all that you chose, with all that was chosen for you. In his book, The Wind in Both Ears, the Universalist minister and one-time dean at St. Lawrence University, Dr. Angus MacLean, wrote, I believe that in order to be truly free, one must make peace with his or her past. This is a freedom made up of some appreciation, some understanding, some forgiveness. I think it could be a very worthy exercise in this season or in any season to try to sort those three things out when it comes to taking the measure of one's life, wherever you happen to be on your life journey. Think about it for a minute. What is it you can look back upon that you truly value and appreciate and celebrate? What can you offer an unreservedly yes to? And then there are, no doubt, certain things that got visited upon you which you cannot value or appreciate. Are you able to understand how they happened? Second thing. And then, when appreciation or understanding are difficult, if not impossible, then can forgiveness of others or even of yourself, can that come into play? Appreciation, understanding, and forgiveness. I think being able to look at your life through those three lenses is also to know a measure of joy. The freedom, to stay with this for just a minute, of which Dr. MacLean writes here, is not the freedom of forgetting or dismissing, which isn't really freedom at all, but rather it's the freedom of reconciliation, of being reconciled to oneself, to all that brought you here, The life that you chose as well as the life that chose you, with its joys, its pains, and all that's in between. We know we're in a season now where remembrances are especially pronounced. Seems to happen this time of year. Certain aspects of our past, of our history, can become very present. And some of those remembrances, hopefully most of those remembrances, for all of you, bring us great joy. Yet others can remind us in ways not always pleasant of the unhealed parts of ourselves and our world. This is a season that reminds us of our need to be at peace with our personal selves. For having this kind of peace, the peace of which Dr. McLean writes, is yet another condition that keeps joy available. And finally, I want to pick up on Taylor's words about joy being pried from the stones of existence. For those stones of existence can at times be quite weighty. I'm going to go into this last part by telling the story from our Unitarian Universalist history of how we got our closing hymn for today. It's a good case in point. The hymn's called I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day. It's by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Little side trip for a minute here. Longfellow, as I'm sure you know, was one of our country's best known 19th century lyric poets. Most famous poem, again, as you know, is Paul Revere's Ride, which made Mr. Revere a Revolutionary War hero, even though his ride was cut short by the British before he really got it going. Never mind that. Longfellow was also a lifelong Unitarian. He lived much of his life in Portland, Maine. The First Parish Church, Unitarian Universalist of Portland, still marks the Longfellow pew in their sanctuary. If you're ever up there, check it out. It's one of those, it's a church, still has little doors on the pews there, and on one of the doors, a little plaque, Longfellow pew there. It's where Henry sat when he went to church. Well, Longfellow wrote, I Heard the Bells, at what was surely the most painful and despairing time of his life. It was during the Civil War. And Longfellow was in a very low state of mind and spirit. In 1861, just as the war was getting underway, right at the outset of the war, his wife had died, horribly tragic accident, after being burned all over when a candle in their home turned over and lit some drapes and started a fire. Longfellow barely survived the burns he got himself, and the reason we always see him in a beard was he grew the beard to cover the scars from those burns that were on his face. And then there was the war itself. Longfellow was a strong abolitionist, but he had hoped that the slavery issue could be resolved in a peaceful way. This, as we know, was not to be. His son Charles went off to join the Union Army. He was severely wounded, sent home to Portland to the care of his father, not knowing if he would survive. And it was while caring for his son, who eventually did recover, and in the wake of the loss of his wife, that Longfellow came up against his own crisis of faith. It wasn't just over whether or not he could still believe in the God in whom he'd always trusted, but rather whether there was also any kind of hope for humanity to turn from its warring ways and seek the ways of peace. So it was in the midst of his emotional and spiritual pain, his own great stones of existence, that Longfellow heard bells announcing the arrival of Christmas in Portland. On a purely prosaic level, there was little for him to be hopeful about. And when we think of all the wars, all the myriad of human tragedies, all the terrible injustices we human beings have a way of inflicting upon one another, all that's come and gone since Longfellow's time, we might well feel the same thing he was feeling then. But what he heard in the bells was a message that says we human beings still have to maintain a vision. We still have to maintain a hope. We still have to maintain a quest for true joy, one that transcends even the harshest realities of our day or of any day. Well, the language and the style of the poem are those of mid-19th century New England. They reflect the theology of mid-19th century Unitarianism as well. But while written in the context of a particular religious faith at a particular point in time, the words taken as a whole can point to a universal longing, that both encompasses and transcends the bounds of any one faith, any one time or place. Fun arrives, contributes its brief sensation, and leaves. Joy is the product of effort, time, and sacrifice. It is pride from the great stones of existence. It is the fulfillment we all seek. In the midst of effort and sacrifice and his own very heavy stones of existence, Longfellow at least caught a glimpse of the fulfillment we all seek. So let's sing together the song he wrote about that moment. It's number 240, I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day.